Produced by PI Media. Hi and welcome to CP Radio. I'm Ran Levy.
So up until last year or two, activism mostly was defined as something that Anonymous affiliated.
Sergei Shaikovits, leader of the threat intelligence group at Checkpoint Research. Like most threat analysts, he spent a good deal of time learning about and reckoning with hacktivist groups like Anonymous.
Kind of decentralized and unstructured collectives that everyone can join to them, can open a Twitter and tell, I'm Anonymous now, and that's my agenda. So accordingly, those hacktivist groups in the past had really a wide range of agendas and wide range of targets.
Generally, members of Anonymous abide by certain shared principles: internet privacy, anti-state, collective action, and revolution. But because members of Anonymous are, well, anonymous, anybody can theoretically call themselves a member, and so things get muddy.
I would even maybe say they didn't have any clear ideology. In many cases, the agendas were changing. In many cases, they even had contradicting agendas. For example, in the US, in the elections of 2016, we saw that some anonymous attacks supported Donald Trump, and some of them supported Hillary Clinton.
Anonymous targeted governments, corporations, even individuals. The playbook, in almost all of these cases, is the same. For example,
every year, I think for the last 10, 12 years or something like this, around the 7th of April, there is Operation Cold of Israel, that everyone who opposes to existence of Israel is called to attack Israel infrastructures. Well, in the first years when it started, it was able to create some buzz.
Creating buzz is often the goal, even more so than doing actual damage or achieving anything meaningful.
Those are very DDoS attacks against either completely not significant websites or really niche pages of big companies that are not in real use. And this way they can claim, we are now took down the biggest payment card company in Israel. But basically they executed a DDoS attack against really a page of these companies that they never use and is not used by their clients.
After years of overhyped DDoS attacks, it's hardly a shock anymore when the group makes announcements or performs those attacks. They hardly make the news like they used to. In a way, everybody just got used to hacktivists.
So that's how it was until now. So around 2 years ago, in the end of 2020, we saw the beginning of the shift. We saw it in the Middle East, in Israel and in Iran. There were several hacktivist groups like Hackers of Savior, Black Shadow and Moses Staff who started operating against targets in Israel. And mostly it was a destructive activity. It wasn't like a regular hacktivism, anonymous-like hacktivism, to conduct several DDoS attacks or site defacements. Those were much more sophisticated and significant attacks that included a ransom.
What were all these new groups getting out of destroying Israeli infrastructure?
Their main goal was to attack and create as much as possible buzz, media buzz around the attack. I will give you an example. A major insurance company in Israel was attacked by one of the groups, but it was a case without really expectation to get the money and the extortion payment, and all the negotiation with the victim and everything was very public in this case.
Just like Anonymous in Op Israel, these new hacktivist groups were trying to embarrass the Israeli state. But they were not an anarchist collective of random basement hackers. In fact, in direct contrast to Anonymous, they were also operating on behalf of Iranian government interests, almost as if they were a state-supported entity.
But at that time point, it was relatively limited because, you know, it was just in Israel, a small country in the Middle East, and it didn't affect most of the world.
That changed earlier this year.
the launch of Russia-Ukrainian war with the beginning of it. The Minister of Digitalization of Ukraine posted in his Twitter that Ukraine recruits hackers to support their agenda, and opened the Telegram channel, and there he started posting targets in Russia that he asked those hacktivists from all over the world who support Ukraine to attack. So this is a very, very, let's call it, clear case of state-affiliated hacktivism, and in this case it's even much more. It's just state-guided hacktivism.
You couldn't pick two countries with more hacktivists than Ukraine and Russia. So when the latter invaded the former, it was like two neutron stars colliding.
With the development of the war, what happened is that we saw more and more pro-Russian groups started appearing. That groups that support the Russian agenda and the Russian narrative. There were attacks against Ukrainian infrastructure, cyber attacks, and in the same day there were physical attacks. We also, in the hacktivism patterns, we saw that everyone who opposes, for example, Russia diplomatically is being hit by pro-Russian hacktivism.
The Russian hacktivists were ultimately an outgrowth of existing Russian hacking groups, with a splash of politics thrown in. For example,
previously, there was some botnet called Killnet that provided some services in the underground, something like this, but not something significant. And with the launch of the Russia-Ukrainian war, they established them as an hacktivism group.
The Killnet hackers, who previously used to provide malware as a service for profit, were now enlisted in Russia's conquest. They became a useful tool for Putin.
In the first month or two, they mostly, as expected, attacked Ukraine. That's something expected, but around end of March, they completely shifted their effort.
Take, for example, a Killnet campaign from this past June.
What happened there is that as part of European Union sanctions against Russia, Lithuania decided to cease the transition of some goods to Kaliningrad. Kaliningrad is a Russian exclave that's located somewhere between Lithuania and Poland, and Russia has to move through Lithuania for the transits. At this point, Lithuania decided to stop those transits, and immediately, of course, the official Russia didn't like it, and Minister of Foreign Affairs of Russia asked Lithuania to stop their sanctions, and it's inappropriate to stop transits for irregular citizens of Russia in Kaliningrad and everything. And the same day, Killnet started executing massive DDoS attacks against Lithuania. What is very unique about those attacks is that they were very, very successful. They were not executed against some niche websites in Lithuania or something like this. They were executed against a variety of big governmental and major governmental websites and against different big private sector websites. That's important to mention. And one of the things that was affected by those DDoS attacks is also National Data Transfer Network, the secure data transfer network, and it impacted a lot of essential services in Lithuania. Killnet, of course, used it for their public relations, and they claimed that around 70% of Lithuanian internet websites were not accessible for several days during the attack out of Lithuania. So actually, as a result, we can see that Killnet was able for several days to cut off most of the country out of the worldwide internet.
If Killnet were like the hacktivists of old, they might have performed a DDoS attack against some easy target, an old, unused, or niche website without much traffic, and then way overhyped the results in the media. But this was not anonymous. This was not 2003.
The unique thing here is that those were not only claims of Killnet. The official Lithuania admitted most of the claims. They didn't contradict that outside of Lithuania, most of the websites are not accessible.
When a country is offended one day, and then hackers from that country take action the next day, it's hard to avoid the obvious connection between those hackers and that country.
So these groups clearly advance nation-state interests. Could they just be patriotic renegades, or are they government affiliated?
Unfortunately, we don't know.
Like any criminal enterprise, these hacktivist groups keep their internal affairs as secret as possible, making their actual connection to the governments they serve difficult to prove.
Some will claim some hacktivism group are more related to specific government, some are separated, some are just aligned. It's very difficult in most cases to be confident about this. Because yes, maybe some of the dozens of the groups that are Russia affiliated are completely independent. It definitely can be possible. But all of them serve specific agendas, and that's how we see now the hacktivism. And I would also even separate between the leaders of the groups to the regular people who let's work in those groups. Because it can be also that in some cases, only the leaders of the group really understand the funding, the real affiliation, whether there is affiliation or not with specific governments. And maybe the regular members who execute the attacks even don't know it. They just kind of execute because they think it's a patriotic group. And I would say they even don't care. I can believe that many of the regular members in those groups like Killnet, they are patriotic. They are pro-Russia patriotic and they support Russia interests and they don't really care whether, you know, the group was one day in the past created by Russia government or just Killmilk is an independent person who decided to be a very patriotic guy and establish this group.
It's precisely because they're not official, like an actual military group would be, that they can recruit all kinds of people. Criminals, students, or simply anyone who wants the job and doesn't care enough to investigate the fine print closely enough. When you think about it, these new hacktivist groups are perfect weapons. They can recruit anybody. They effectively carry out operations beneficial to the state. But they also maintain some distance from the state, allowing them to do things even the government and military couldn't get away with.
So there is a kind of deniability of a government, because mostly governments don't want to take any responsibility for activity against other government, whether it's especially in cyberspace. So here, if there is just activist groups that they claim we are just patriotic, we support the interests of our government, but we are simple people. So there is no any legal or international consequences for the countries themselves and for the governments.
Beyond plausible deniability, there are all kinds of other benefits to this particular model of state-sponsored cyber destruction.
I think one thing that the same group always sticks to the same agenda. That's a big difference, and I think it can be a benefit, it can be a drawback. It depends how we look on this. But we know that specific groups will always support this and this agenda, so it's possible to expect whom they will attack. Because in the past, it was really unexpected what will be the next campaign of Anonymous. It can be now against wealth preservation or specific politician or something. Here we know that groups who support the Russian narrative will always attack targets connected to it. Or pro-Iranian groups will support the agenda and narrative for Iranian regime. So that's one important thing about the new hacktivism and how it defined. The second is the structure. And it also connected to the ideology. That in this new type of hacktivism, there is clear leadership. There is always clear leadership and there are clear targets. It's not like every member can define whom he will attack. There is something structured that comes from the top to the bottom. Quite an opposite from Anonymous. And the definition of the targets, and it creates, again, consistency. Another thing that the new hacktivism created, I would say, are much better public relations. I think one of the things that those state-affiliated groups understood, that the key is to build robust public relations and to build a good operation about it. Because they are more successful, but it's even more important how they show their success to the media and to the world.
Now that Killnet and groups like it have demonstrated the effectiveness of this new brand of hacktivism, their model is spreading around the globe. For example, back in the place where this whole thing started.
So, Homeland Justice is a pro-Iranian hacktivism group that attacked Albania in mid-July this year. Basically, there were two interesting occasions that should have taken place in Albania. One is the Free Iran World Summit, which talks about Iranian government and all this, that was cancelled earlier this year in Albania after a lot of pressure of Iran. And the second thing that's important to keep in mind is that Mujahideen Halek, MEK, an organization that Tehran considers as terrorist, have big refugee camps in Albania. And Albania allows them to operate from their territory. And what happened is in mid-July, suddenly major attacks hit Albanian government. It included both ransomware-style file encryptors and disk wiping malware families. Basically, big destructive attacks against the government of Albania. We saw already several reports, including by FBI and US governments that assisted to Albania to investigate those, that showed that it was a very long planned act of Iranian government that kind of established and used the name of Homeland Justice to execute those attacks.
More recently, the trend has moved west.
We see it specifically now in Latin America. A hacktivism group called Guacamaya that just last week started targeting a lot of countries in South America, and they claim they have one agenda: to oppose anything connected to colonialism and environmental imperialism. So we see that the things just started several months ago in Ukraine, in Middle East, everything already propagate and proliferate. So we expect that more and more such groups will appear in the cyber ecosystem.
Today's hacktivist groups aren't cute. They aren't kidding around. They aren't anonymous, planting a flag and shouting victory over some website nobody uses or cares about. These are well-organized, coordinated, and sophisticated APTs operating as it suits them, both independent of and on behalf of their home governments. It's working, and it will only become a bigger and better problem in years to come. That's it for this episode. Thank you for listening. For past episodes, visit Checkpoint Research blog at research.checkpoint.com, and you can follow Checkpoint Research on Twitter or follow me at @RanLevy. That's R-A-N-L-E-V-I. CP Radio is produced by PI Media, written by Nate Nilsson, produced by Yotam Halachmi, and edited and narrated by me, Ran Levy. See you next episode. Bye-bye.